Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ina Ramos, and I'd like to welcome you to the Minority Fellowship Program Orientation Webinar. This webinar is brought to you by the SAMHSA Minority Fellowship Program Coordinating Center. I will now turn things over to our first presenter, CMHS Branch Chief Eric Weekly, who will provide words of welcome and an overview of SAMHSA.
Ina, thanks for that introduction. And let me start off by saying on behalf of Dr. Anita Everett, who is our director of the Center for Mental Health Services, congratulations on being awarded a fellowship, and thank you for your work. So my role today is to give you an introduction to CMHS and SAMHSA. And to start that off, I'd always like to start off with our purpose and mission. So I'm going to read this a little bit to you here. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is the agency within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that leads public health efforts to advance the behavioral health of the nation and to improve the lives of individuals living with mental and substance use disorders and their families. So I think that says a lot in a few words. So we're really looking at systematic ways that we can look at information, data, and help states and communities build systems to support the work as they serve people with mental and substance use disorders. So I'm going to provide a little history, talk a little bit about SAMHSA's strategic initiatives and key priorities, and also just end up with a little bit about workforce and how the MFP program fits into that work that we do here. A little recognition that, at least in Western culture, the way it's gone, we've gone from looking at people who have mental disorders as having some sort of possession or, you know, other outside influence, you know, through history, until we really got to maybe the 1700s. And then looking at things like asylums, many of you probably have studied in psychology or some public health history, the early work in England and just the terrible conditions that people lived in. And then really moving into, you know, some of the work in the U.S. early in the 1800s, where people, you know, were a little more enlightened, had some enlightened ideas about maybe country living or it would be good for people. And if you, depending on where you're from, you might be familiar with the county poor farms or different asylums that were set up in the country that revolved around work and treatment in that way. And really not until the 1950s with the advent of medication that really did begin to help people with serious mental illness was there a move towards people living in the community. And now we've really moved into an era of recovery, peer support, and person-centered planning. So really understanding that people with serious mental illness, it may not be that way for them. They have periods of where they need assistance and periods where things are going well for them. But how do we set up systems that help them at the state and local level? And how do we at the federal level help to do that? A bit of a challenge and overview. So there are about a little under 50 million people in the U.S. who have any mental illness. So any mental illness could be something very mild, some depression, to somebody who has schizophrenia. And this is from the National Survey of Drug Use and Health. We call it the NISDA survey. And if you like data, if you haven't are familiar with that, you can check out our website. And right on the front page is a data link at the SAMHSA website. And there's other really, you know, good data there that you might find useful. And of that 46 million, about 11 million people have what we would consider serious mental illness. And when we say serious mental illness, we mean people that have a diagnosable DSM-5 mental disorder that is serious enough that it affects their daily living. Something else we know from the surveys is that major depressive episodes and serious mental illness among young adults is rising. People with serious mental illness have higher rates of suicide than the general public, about 25 times higher. But we also know that just addressing people's depression doesn't necessarily address their suicidality. So there's work to be done there. We know that there's health inequity. Those with SMI die about 10 years earlier than the general population. We know that there are many communities that don't have access to the services and treatment that people need. We also know that there are about 2 million people living in prisons and jails that are in some way incarcerated with serious mental illness, and that about a third of those don't get treatment. We also know that this really leads to a revolving door. People aren't treated when they're incarcerated, and they come out and aren't linked to the services that they need. So what are some other challenges for today? We know that less than half of the people who have depression get the treatment that they need, especially young people. We know that we're doing a little better for people with serious mental illness, about maybe two-thirds of people with serious mental illness receive treatment. That still means that a third of people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depressive episodes aren't really getting the treatment that they need. So that's where SAMHSA comes in. So we were established in 1992. A little history, we were part of, before we became SAMHSA, part of the National Institutes of Health, and we broke off in 92, and the work that we are doing really is community-based, community-focused for the most part. So how do we translate research into practice? And that's where SAMHSA specializes. So our budget for last year was just a little under $6 billion. So it sounds like a lot of money until you start spreading that around to all the states and territories and the people who need it. And looking just at the CMHS budget, it's about $1.5 billion. And you'll hear more about this, but about $800 million of that, a little less than that, goes to the states for the Community Mental Health Block Grant. And our current staffing is about 600 people at SAMHSA. We do have a strategic plan that fits into the overall Health and Human Services plan, and how NFP fits into that plan. We have a priority number 5 in the SAMHSA plan is strengthening health professional training and education. So that's what we're working on with you now. And then there's also something called the Interdepartmental Serious Mental Illness Coordinating Committee. So in 2017, that committee was established, and it's a high level committee. So it starts, there's a number of federal members, including HHS, Department of Justice, the Veterans Affairs, Housing and Urban Development. So there's a number of federal partners. And then also there are people with lived experience on the committee, practitioners, advocates. So it's really looking at what can we do as a nation to fill the gaps in our current system. And you can go to our website and also just probably Google ISMIC, and the report from 2017 will come up, and there's 45 recommendations in the report. And then we have another report due to Congress in 2021. So finally, just for the Minority Fellowship Program, there's been over 3,500 fellows since the inception in the early 1970s. So you have a long history of people coming before you doing this work. The focus has been on leading, teaching, conducting research at our nation's top educational institutions. People that have MFP fellowships have gone on to lead professional guilds and organizations, conducting innovations in the community, reducing health disparities, and changing policy. So again, thank you for your work on this, and best wishes and good luck in your career. And I'm going to turn this over to Deborah and Darlene to talk more about the details and get to the next section. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. This is Darlene Seguir with SAMHSA. I work in the center. I work for treatment. I'm going to go over some information regarding what we do in treatment and answer any questions you all may have. CSET's mission is to promote community-based substance abuse treatment and recovery services for individuals and families in every community. We work close to close gaps between available treatment capacity and demand, supports the adoption and adoption of evidence-based and best practice by community-based treatment programs and services, and improve and strengthen substance abuse treatment organization and systems. We currently have a new director, Dr. Luis Trevisan. He joined SAMHSA several months ago, and he's been very committed to ensuring that treatment is available and services are available across the country. In CSAT, we have three offices. We have the Office of the Director, Office of Program Analysis and Coordination, as well as Office of Consumer Affairs. We also have three divisions, Division of Pharmaceutical, I didn't think I said that right, Therapy, Division of Services Improvement, and Division of State and Community Assistance. Within CSAT, DPT manages the day-to-day oversight activities necessary to implement federal regulations on the use of substance use disorder medications, such as methadone and buprenorphine. And DPT supports the accreditation and certification of more than 1,500 opioid treatment programs, also referred to as OTPs, that collectively treat more than 300,000 patients each year. They also implement the Data 2000 waiver program. They also produce publications such as the Opioid Overdose Prevention Toolkit and the Opioid Overdose Prevention and Response Integrated Curriculum, as well as other publications that could be found on SAMHSA.gov on the website. Division of Services Improvement, DSI, has various programs that we're working in. You can see it right now on the slide. I won't go over each one, but DSI is responsible for the oversight of the majority of the Center of Substance Abuse Treatment discretionary grants and programs. We improve access, reduce barriers from a high-quality evidence-based treatment and recovery support services. Publications of focuses are youth and families, women pregnant and postpartum, individuals at risk or infected with HIV/AIDS, adult and juvenile justice, quality improvement, and workforce development. We also have the Health Systems Branch, HSB branch. Within that, we promote HIV and hepatitis prevention in minority communities by addressing substance use disorder treatment, aligned with the President's national strategy. Within DPT, DPB, we do a lot more things pertaining to adolescent and transitional aged youth. And then under Quality Improvement and Workforce Development Branch, I'm sure many of you have heard of Addiction Technology Transfer Centers. They offer a lot of trainings that are being done all year round, as well as other programs. Moving toward the Division of State and Community Assistance, referred to as DISCO, there's three programs, the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant, and the Opioid State Targeted Response Grant, and the State Opioid Response. These programs are jointly administrated by the Performance Partnership Grant Branch, Division of State and Community Assistance within CSAT, as well as the State Administration Branch Division of State Programs and CSAP Prevention at SAMHSA. 50 states, including D.C., Red Lake Indians, and 10 jurisdictions received an annual allotment. In FY18, it was in over almost $2 billion. Now, there's 56 grants, formula-based. Funding level at year two was almost $500 million in fiscal year 17. It provides over $1 billion in new funding for grants to states to address the opioid crisis. There's a lot of things that we're doing pertaining to the opioid crisis. Moving along to the Office of Consumer Affairs, that's where you'll find out a lot of things pertaining to National Recovery Month in September. They also work with SAMHSA stakeholders, develop initiatives, and foster a better understanding of the needs of those in recovery and families, as well as get information out to the public. Much of the information and publications that we have, again, is on the SAMHSA store. We also co-lead the Brass Test Project and, again, the National Recovery Month Program. Moving on to the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention, CSAP. The mission for CSAP is to improve behavioral health through evidence-based prevention approaches. CSAP works with federal, state, public, and private organizations to develop comprehensive prevention systems by several ways. One, providing national leadership in the development of policies, programs, and services to prevent the onset of illegal drug use, prescription drug misuse, and alcohol misuse and abuse, and underage alcohol and tobacco use. Promoting effective substance abuse prevention practices that enable states and communities and other organizations to apply prevention knowledge effectively. As a result of CSAP's work, we created supportive workplaces in schools and communities, drug-free and crime-free neighborhoods, positive connections with friends and family. The major function areas is drug-free communities, drug-free workforce programs, state programs, and underage drinking. Within CSAT, there's two offices. There's the Office of the Director, and then the Office of Program Analysis and Coordination. And then there's four divisions, Division of Community Programs, Division of State Programs, Division of System Development, and Division of Workplace Programs. The Division of Community programs supports the Community Grants and Emerging Issue Branch, Community Grants and Systems Improvement Branch, and the Community Grants and Program Development Branch. The Division of State Programs supports the State Administrative Branch, and the Division of Systems Development supports the Performance and Technical Assistance Branch. Three of CSAP's grants-funded programs are the Community-Based Coalition Enhancement Grants to address local drug crises, Prevention Technology Transfer Centers, Cooperative Agreements, and then Strategic Prevention Framework Partnership for Success. Three of CSAP's grants-funded programs includes the Community-Based Coalition Enhancement Grants to address local drug crises, the Prevention Technology Transfer Centers, PTTC, the Cooperative Agreements, and the Strategic Prevention Framework Partnership for Success. For more information on CSAP grant programs and resources, you can go to their website through the SAMHSA.gov website. And that wraps it up for prevention.
Thank you, Darlene. My name is Dr. Rose, and I'm going to give you a little bit of information about the Center for Mental Health.
Under the leadership of Dr. Anita Everett, the Center for Mental Health Services leads federal efforts to promote prevention, treatment, and recovery supports for Americans with mental disorders. As a result of its efforts, CMHS's work has been and continues to strengthen the nation's mental health system by helping states improve and increase the quality and range of their treatment, rehabilitation, and support. It also encourages a range of programs such as systems of care to respond to the increasing number of mental, emotional, and behavioral problems among Americans' children. And CMHS ensures that scientifically established findings and practice-based knowledge are applied in preventing and treating mental disorders. CMHS has three offices: the Office of the Director, Office of Consumer Affairs, Office of Program Analysis and Coordination. And we have three divisions: the Division of Prevention, Traumatic Stress, and Special Programs, the Division of State and Community Systems Development, and Division of Service and Systems Improvement. Division of Service and Systems Improvement, DSSI, the key focus there is to work with homeless services, community support, child and adolescent families. Division of Prevention, Traumatic Stress, and Special Programs, the DPTSSP division, key focus on emergency mental health, traumatic stress, and suicide prevention. Division of State and Community Systems, which is DSCSD, key focus is treatment and support services for severely mentally ill adults, children, and youth with serious emotional disturbance, and protection and advocacy for individuals with mental illness. Some key Center for Mental Health Services programs include the Community Mental Health Block Grant, which is a program that provides funds and technical assistance to all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and six specific jurisdictions. Grantees use the funds to provide comprehensive community-based mental health services to adults with serious mental illness and to children with serious emotional disturbances, and to monitor progress in implementing a comprehensive community-based mental health system. The Protection and Advocacy for Individuals with Mental Illness Program, which we call PAMI, provides services to protect and advocate for the rights of people with significant mental illness and emotional impairment who are at risk for or in danger of abuse, neglect, or right violations. The funds are used to support legal-based advocacy services for individuals residing in facilities, jails, juvenile detention centers, prisons, and residing in the community. The National Child Traumatic Stress Initiative improves treatment and services for children, adolescents, and families who have experienced traumatic events. SAMHSA has a wealth of free resources such as publications, apps, and other resources on treatment, prevention, and recovery. These resources are available for health providers and the general public. For example, we have the Behavioral Health Treatment Services Locator, which is a confidential and anonymous source of information for persons seeking treatment in the United States and the U.S. territories for substance use, addiction, and mental health problems. The locator is free and available 24/7, 365 days a year. And if you would like to get more information about it, you can definitely go to our website. Some of SAMHSA's online resources include mobile apps. SAMHSA's free mobile apps offer easy access to treatment and prevention tools for opioid use disorder, suicide, bullying, disaster response, and underage drinking. For example, the Suicide Safe app helps healthcare providers integrate suicide prevention strategies and offers tips on assisting patients who are suicidal. The No Bullying app, you will find simple conversation starters to prevent bullying and help kids build a resilience. The Alcohol FX app helps increase students' knowledge of alcohol's negative consequences. Also, you can download publications on treatment, prevention, and recovery for mental and substance use disorders. SAMHSA funds two types of grants, block grants and discretionary grants. Block grant is a non-competitive formula grant mandated by the U.S. Congress. Eligible entities must submit an annual application and demonstrate statutory and regulatory compliance in order to receive the formula-based funding. SAMHSA is responsible for two block grant programs, the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant and the Community Mental Health Block Grant. Discretionary grants, SAMHSA selects the awardees based on merit and eligibility to get funded. SAMHSA announces grant funding opportunities through Funding Opportunity Announcements, or FOA. Each FOA contains all the information you need to apply for a grant. You can go to SAMHSA.gov/grants and grants.gov to review grant announcements and awards. Questions about a specific grant, you can contact the individual listed under the FOA. And for general questions, you can contact the Division of Grants Management. For information about serving as SAMHSA uses peer reviewers who are subject matter experts to review discretionary grant applications. If you're interested in serving as a peer reviewer, you can visit the SAMHSA website and get the information to apply to be a reviewer. If you're interested in experiencing hands-on experiences at SAMHSA, SAMHSA's internship program provides opportunities for student interns to gain practical experiences through projects, special assignments, or research that support federal, state, and community-based program policies and best practices in the prevention and treatment of substance abuse and mental illness. And if I'm correct, I think most of the internship programs are paid programs. Okay. SAMHSA has programs and campaigns that offer information, training, and technical assistance to improve the quality and delivery of behavioral health services across the nation. For example, the Evidence-Based Practice Resource Center provides communities, clinicians, policymakers, and others with the information and tools to incorporate evidence-based practices into their communities and clinical settings. SAMHSA's newest resource is the Technology Transfer Centers program. The purpose of the Technology Transfer Center program is to develop and strengthen the specialized behavioral health care and primary health care workforce that provides prevention, treatment, and recovery support services for substance use disorders and mental illness. The TTC, which is the Technology Transfer Center program, is comprised of three networks, the Addiction Technology Transfer Center, the ATTC, the Mental Health Technology Transfer Center, the MHTTC, and the Prevention Technology Transfer Center, PTTC. Each network is comprised of one national coordinator center, 10 regional centers, one American Indian and Alaskan Native focus center, one Hispanic and Latino focus center. And if you're interested in getting more information about it, you can see all the services on the SAMHSA website. Okay, Ina.
Okay, thank you so much, Eric, Darlene, and Deborah. So before we go forward, we did receive a question for Eric. During your presentation, you talked about the ability of getting national demographic statistics on mental health from a particular website. You used an acronym, and so if you could reshare that information, that would be helpful.
Sure. The easy way to do it, again, if you go to the SAMHSA website, which is just SAMHSA.gov, right on the front page, there is a data at the top. There's a data link, and it's the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, NISDA. Some people will say NISDA, so if you, that's what it stands for. So that's where there's really good data. That is a survey, and so they extrapolate from this national survey the numbers that many of the numbers that we use as far as people who have mental and substance use disorders. There's more data. So for the block grant, there's something called the Uniform Reporting System, URS. So all the states are surveyed and have information about their state mental health systems. The substance abuse, they have similar, it's called TEDS data, I believe, which is treatment episode. I'm blanking, but there's data that is more substance abuse focused. So there's really a lot of data there. There's actually more surveys and data that's collected from states and local providers. So hopefully that helps.
Thank you. And so we had one additional question that I'll take at this moment. You all went over, I think this is for Deborah and Darlene, you all went over some of amazing programs that SAMHSA has. How can the fellows get more involved in the programs and with SAMHSA in general?
Well, a lot of the programs, as we were saying, are grant programs. So if they're interested in applying for a grant, they can go on the SAMHSA website and look through the list of grants at SAMHSA.gov or grants.gov to see what programs that they're interested in. And far as like the internship program, you can also go on the website and see how you can apply for the internship program.
Thank you so much. And so for the next portion of our presentation, we're going to hear from Dr. Frieda Outlaw, who will provide the background and historical overview of the MFP program. Dr. Outlaw will be followed. You'll hear from Deborah Rose again, who will provide information on program objectives and expectations for MFP fellows. And then you'll hear receive information on the Minority Fellowship Program Coordinating Center from our program staff. So, Dr. Outlaw, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, everyone. It is my honor and pleasure to give the history and overview of the MFP program because I am an alum of the Minority Fellowship Program at the American Nurses Association, and I have lived through much of this history as it's developed. As you can see from this slide, it has been 45 years since the Center for Minority Health at the National Institute of Mental Health used data to determine that there was a deficit in the number of minority mental health professionals who could, according to research findings, provide the most comprehensive, culturally competent care to populations of people who were becoming more racially, ethnically, and culturally diverse, a trend that was projected to continue into the future, thus the need for the urgency to become more active. And in that same year, the center in 73, when the Center for Minority Health at the National Institute of Health started to be alarmed about this, the next year, the Center for Minority Mental Health invited the American Sociological Association to submit a grant proposal so that they could start to do some training from a sociological point of view about ethnic and minority, training about this trend with ethnic minority sociologists, emerging sociologists. So the first action was initially the invitation to the American Sociological Association to submit a grant proposal to support doctoral level training, as I've said. And with that, then there was some identification that there were some core people who were doing actual work on the ground, as we say, boots on the ground, people who were actually doing research, and they were doing practice, and they were doing some policy work. And they identified these what they call core professionals that provided mental health and substance abuse services were also awarded grants through their professional organizations to attend to this problem and to eliminate health disparities. And those four core professionals, as you can see again, were the American Nurses Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, and the Council on Social Work Education. Other key milestones happened from that genesis. And some of those key milestones were that and Eric has already talked about this a little bit, that in 1992, the Minority Fellowship Program was transferred to the newly formed Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration called SAMHSA. And it was determined that SAMHSA's mission and goals were closely aligned with the Minority Fellowship Program and the things that they were trying to do. So therefore, the transfer. Now, as we move along from 1992, other organizations were emerging that were providing services that were thought to make vital additions, which were thought to enrich and broaden the core professionals. And these organizations could provide, also help to provide comprehensive cultural competent services to populations of need, and therefore try to impact the disproportionate health disparities and lack of health equality. And these organizations were 207, as you can see from the slide, the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, in 2012, the National Board for Certified Counselors, and in 2014, the Association for Addiction Professionals, we call NADAC. In this grant cycle, however, as things move and change and emerge, in the 2019 grant proposal, NADAC became a subcontractor of the National Board for Certified Counselors. But that work goes on and is just broadened by that combination and that merging of the work. In 2014, now is the time, was the response really to Sandy Hook? It was a fellowship program focused on youth. It was launched, and it focused on increasing access to mental health services for youth by supporting master's level education for the core professionals. The populations served were children, adolescents, and youth in transition, the youth 16 to 25. This fellowship has now been incorporated into the new grant to support master's level professionals working across the lifespan. Also, concurrently, there were behavioral health services that were underrepresented, and the whole issue of addictions and was emerging, and there was the MFPAC, which was also made available at the master's level for addiction counselors. In 2018, as I said, the MFP master's program expanded their focus to recruit master's level fellows who are seeking to work with additional underserved minority populations across the lifespan. Therefore, the master's programs are no longer limited to individuals seeking to work only with youth populations. They can work with youth populations. They can also work with populations across the lifespan. In sum, then, these are resources that feature the exciting culturally and linguistically competent work of the MF fellows across all the grantees. These organizations are vital additions which have enriched and broadened the core of professionals that can provide comprehensive cultural competence services using data. And we are very proud of the contributions that grantees have made, and they're captured. You can see some of the contributions that they have made in a number of ways, including the newsletters, publications, they've made contributions in local, regional, national, and international presentations. And just to end it then, let me just say, if you go to our website, each grantee's website, and other social media platforms, you can see for yourself the rich contributions that they have made. It is also meaningful that many of the fellows in these programs have lived the experience of socioeconomic challenges and the associated disparities, and have been able to infuse into their work how they have overcome many of these challenges, adding another level of commitment and compassion to their work. And again, I encourage everyone to look at all the grantee websites for how these fellows are adding to increasing the diverse workforce and impacting health disparities in a positive way. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Outlaw. Deborah, you're up next.
Thank you, Ina. As stated earlier, the purpose of the Minority Fellowship Program is to reduce health disparities and improve healthcare outcomes of racially and ethnically diverse populations by increasing the number of culturally competent behavioral health professionals available to underserved populations in the public and private nonprofit sector. SAMHSA's Nordic Fellowship Program goals and objectives for our fellows are to increase the number of trained professionals, reduce behavioral health disparities, improve outcomes for ethnic minorities, provide financial support for MFP fellows, provide access to cutting-edge training opportunities, provide resources to MFP fellows, and to collect data to validate the MFP program. SAMHSA's expectations for the MFP fellows are: 1, work to improve behavioral health conditions of ethnic and racial minorities. SAMHSA is here to support the MFP fellows and to commit to working in underserved communities. 2, to assist SAMHSA in maintaining program funding. We ask you just to please, if you just complete the program. The more fellows coming through the program and returning to underserved communities, teaching and or doing further research in this area will allow us to be able to justify the importance of the Minority Fellowship Program. And we know your schedules are busy, but it's so important for fellows to complete surveys and to provide data needed to justify the need for the program. 3, strengthen your professional foundation. The MFP program will allow fellows to network with other professionals and be mentored by professionals in your discipline. 4, give back. Give back to the community by supporting and working in underserved communities by teaching and continued research. 5, to help SAMHSA to promote the Minority Fellowship Program. The way fellows can do this is talk about the program, share your experiences about the program, and sharing with others and encouraging others to apply for the program. 6, participate in the MFP community of learning. Be available to participate in webinars, read our newsletters, and various trainings, participate in various trainings and technical assistance that is available to you. And 7, complete the SAMHSA surveys. As stated previously, surveys assist in providing information to justify the need for the Minority Fellowship Program. So we just ask you to, if you could just meet those expectations, and then that would help the program stay stronger. And again, I just want to welcome all the new fellows to the program, and we look forward to working with you. Ina?
All right. This is Ina Ramos, not Kelly Wagner, but I'll be speaking on her behalf today. I'm happy to be here to share information with you all about the MFPCC, which is the Minority Fellowship Program Coordinating Center. So the MIATEC team, we're here to provide program support, technical assistance, training opportunities, all in support of the MFP grantees. Our mission is to strengthen communication, improve MFP operations of the grantees, and ultimately to increase the capacity of the behavioral health workforce in underserved communities, which is you all, the fellows, which again, we're pleased to have you and welcome you. MIATEC has, over the past 35 years, been providing training and technical assistance in behavioral health, health disparities, and cultural competence. So we're happy to bring our experiences to share with the grantees and you, the fellows. You know, how do we meet this mission? We work to identify, disseminate information on promising, best, and evidence-based practices. We do this through a few different ways. There are monthly teleconferences that are held with the MFP grantees. Also information that's disseminated through our listserv. And I'm sure that hopefully you've been receiving our listserv messages already. There are also webinars that you'll hear a little bit more about, a quarterly MFP newsletter, and then we have an MFP website that has a resource library. It also has a fellow directory, and it also houses the webinars, newsletters, and other information that can be used by the MFP grantees as well as you, the fellows. Our team consists of Kelly Wagner, who's our project director, myself, Ina Ramos, the senior technical associate or TA specialist, Gretchen Vaughn, who is a senior behavioral health specialist, Asia Louis, who's a TA specialist, and Angel Tolliver, who is our web and IT support lead. And here's our contact information, how you can reach us, and we'll share this with you in the chat box as well. But the telephone number, email, and then the website address is there. Gretchen?
Well, thank you, Ina. Greetings, MFP fellows. I'm Gretchen Chase Vaughn. I'm professionally, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, and I serve as the Coordinating Center Senior Behavioral Health Specialist. And I want to talk to you about the webinars that we're planning for 2020. We have monthly webinars between February and July. Usually they're 90 minutes to 2 hours. Starting in February, we'll be having more webinars, so you have a little break before the new year. The time slot traditionally has been Wednesdays, starting at 2 p.m. Eastern time, similar to this webinar. Each webinar will feature expert facilitators who will provide brief overview slides. But this year, we also want to do something a little bit different, which is we envision these webinars as discussion forums, and we want to make them a format which would allow both current and alumni fellows to have more interdisciplinary discussions about the topic. We know that each of your grantee agencies provides webinars in your discipline, but this is the one time where we get fellows from all the different disciplines to come together to be together on webinars. So we hope that we can invite you as current fellows as well as alumni fellows to participate as discussants on these webinars. And please fill out your profiles and let us know what your areas of expertise are so that we can invite you to participate in discussions, or even at the end of this webinar, you can give us any area of expertise that you'd be willing to participate with us on. We also have archive webinars available on our website. Last year, we had two great webinars on behavioral health disparities, as well as two wonderful webinars on cultural competency and behavioral health. We also had a co-occurring and mental health substance use disorder webinar and a suicide prevention spotlight webinar. So those webinars will be available for you to access the recordings as well as the slides. Just to know the logistics for webinars, similar to this webinar, the notices will be emailed to you via the listserv. You'll log on to the webinars the same way you did this. I know there were some issues with some people not having phone access, so we will attempt to address that. But normally, you both log on the computer as well as call in through your phone. And after the webinar, we always or usually have feedback surveys because we want to get you involved and giving us feedback about how the webinars are working for you. If you have any questions, again, send them to our website link. And as you see below, there's also a link to our archived webinars in these slides. So if you miss a webinar, the slides will usually be ready at least 4 weeks after the webinar occurs. So again, thank you for joining us for this, and I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Gretchen. And so we've also included in the chat box the link if you want to go and check out the archive webinars. So hello again. It's Ina Ramos. I'm the Training and Technical Assistance Lead for the MFPCC. Two things that I want to talk to you about today. The first is the MFP Fellow of the Month profile. Now, this is an opportunity to highlight the work and accomplishments of both current and alumni fellows, MFP fellows. And so we would encourage you, if you're interested in highlighting your work, your MFP experience, we've had, you know, the opportunity to hear some tremendous stories of how people have come to this fellowship and what it's done for them, either currently as a student or in their career now as an alum. So we would, you know, encourage you to let us know if you're interested. We'll share information on how to either nominate someone else or nominate yourself if you're interested in being highlighted. And then there's the MFP e-newsletter. It's published 4 times a year. Old editions are available also on the website. We're going to share that link in the chat box as well. And the articles will have 2 articles that focus on substance abuse and or mental health. We also like to highlight some of the work that the fellows are doing. We include professional development opportunities, news and views, and funding opportunities. And in terms of those articles, we're always looking for contributors. So if you are interested in writing an article, maybe you're doing some very interesting research that you want to share, we'd love to have you. Again, we provided the email address before. We'll provide it again at the end. But if you're interested in being an author or contributing, reach out and let us know. The next few slides are just a few screenshots of what the newsletter looks like on the website. There's kind of the table of contents of what's included, and then there's a snapshot of an article, another article, professional development opportunities, and then news and views and funding opportunities. Also, if you have information about maybe a conference that you want to share, that can go on the professional development portion of the newsletter or on the website, which Angel will talk about briefly, then please feel free to share that information as well. So I'll turn it over to Angel.
Thank you, Ina, and good afternoon to everyone on this webinar. Like Ina said, we will do a quick run through of the MFPCC website, starting with the MFPCC splash page, which you're viewing now. Just a note, MyEdTech does not manage the content of the splash page. This webpage is maintained by SAMHSA. But if you were to do like a Google search or a browser search, the SAMHSA MFP program, if you do a search on an MFP program, this is probably the first webpage that you will see in your search results. The webpage provides an overview of the Minority Fellowship Program. There's also related SAMHSA resources. You can see that on your right sidebar there. And there's general information about how to become an MFP fellow, but also their basic information about the MFP Coordinating Center with a link to the MFPPC website. Once again, that link address is mfpcc.samhsa.gov. The MFPCC website has both public-facing and password-protected features. The password-protected features are restricted to MFP fellows, alumni, and program administrators. Therefore, you have to have a user credential to log into the website. If you do not have credentials, please contact us and we'll get you set up. As Ina stated, contact information will be in the chat box for you to use. Also note that currently we are creating user profiles and login credentials for the MFP 2019-2020 fellows, which is you guys. So give us about 3 to 4 business days if you have not received them as of yet. This process is in progress and you should be getting it shortly. But if you already have credentials and you have forgotten your password, just click that Click Here button, and that will start an automated password recovery process. Now, if you're still having technical difficulties even through the password recovery process, there is also a contact administrator link. You won't see that link until you've actually initiated the automated password recovery process, and it's on that password recovery webpage. This is a screenshot of the My MF page. So the My MF page is basically your user profile webpage. Once you have logged into the website, please take some time to review and update your profile. You can get to your profile by clicking the My Account link that's located in the top navigation bar. You may not see this link. If you're logged into the system, you should see My Account. If you click the My Account link and you're not logged into the system, it'll bring you back to the login page for you to actually get logged in. One thing I want to kind of express here, that your profile is the foundation for networking with other fellows and program alumni. So it's kind of important that you really take some time to complete this profile and periodically log in to keep it up to date. Now, the areas of interest that you select when setting up your profile, this was actually used to match you with other fellows and peers that share common interests. If you look on the left sidebar, you'll see that my matches, there are about 77 people I've been matched up with based upon the areas of interest that I've entered. Also, things that you can do on this page, you can change your privacy settings. Is there some information that you wish to display in your profile? Just select it. And also, too, you have the option of hiding some information, like maybe you don't want, you know, your full address shown in your profile. You can just untick it or uncheck the information, and that will allow you to hide that information from the public-facing searches. You also have the option to update your bio. You can change your password from this page. And there's a link to the calendar, the MFC calendar events also from your profile. Now, one thing I have to tell you that after you've updated your profile, you know, you've keyed in those areas of interest, you have it looking the way you want, you have to click a link that's not really displayed here. It says update my MF page status. You must click this to set your profile to searchable. If you don't click that particular link, your profile won't be seen by others. Now, I've experienced this. I've kind of clicked around and tooled around on the website to see my matches, and I've clicked on their profile and it says it's not available. So please make sure you do the update my MF page status to make your information searchable, and that way you can have a more interactive experience with your peers and find people that are matched up with your interests. This is a screenshot of the MFPCC resources webpage. Now, there's a wealth of searchable information on this webpage that includes webinars, the newsletter archive, there's articles, we have training materials posted here, outcome tools, and other information. You have the option to also search by keyword. You can look on that left sidebar there. You can search by topic area and or SAMHSA strategic initiative. You also can search by your profession, you know, and find information that's kind of tooled and geared towards your profession. There is a quick links option where you can get information readily available. And at that last link on that sidebar suggests a resource. If you have a resource that you would like to submit and share with your peers, basically you would click that link. It will pull up a web form that you can use to submit citations or links to other resources. One thing to note, though, when you go to submit a resource, you have to include an abstract or an introduction. So kind of prepare that beforehand, or you won't be able to complete the suggested resource form. And finally, this is a pretty basic webpage screenshot of the MFPCC Directory of Fellows. This will allow you to search for your peers or a fellow by their discipline. You can search by university or state, last or first name. Or if you can select browse all, and this will actually pull down the entire directory. So this was pretty much just a brief overview. I really encourage you guys to log in, complete your profile, kind of tool around the website. If there are some other suggestions you want to make to us, there's the Contact Us tab on the top navigation bar. Of course, we also will have that contact information in the chat feature that you can send directly email to us with feedback about the website. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Angel. At this time, if you have questions, you can enter them into the chat box and we'll address them. I will share a question that I have received. There's a question about the programs within the MFP. I am currently a Services for Transitional Age Youth Fellow at the master's level. However, I am in the process of applying to doctoral programs. Would I be permitted to apply for the pre-doctoral fellowship in the mental health and substance abuse services? So Deborah, this might be a question for you, or I'm not sure if it's program specific.
You would be able to apply, but you need to identify what specific program that they would want to apply to.
Okay.
Because out of the grant, it sounds like they may want to do, was it psychological, American Psychological Association, or Psychiatric Association, or Council for Social Work Education. They would need to be very specific and identify what program they would want to apply to. And like Dr. Outlaw has said, and then go to the website to see where they would fit and if they would be eligible to apply for the program. Dr. Outlaw, would you have anything to add to that?
No, I think you answered the question very well, Deborah.
Thank you.
Okay. So the next question is for Angel. There's a question about how exactly do you go about getting the credentials for the website?
Okay. So if you are a new fellow, we are actively in a process of sending out user credentials. Once you get those user credentials, you will then get further direction on how to log into the website. I'll let you know now that this website uses two-factor authentication, meaning that you also need to provide a mobile number as well. Now, like I said, we're in a process of setting up these new accounts. If you have an existing account and you're having issues too, you would use the automated password recovery feature or email us. And I think Like, that's about it. So if you're a new fellow, you should be getting your credentials. We've been sending out credentials all day today. We'll be continuing this process throughout the week. And by the end of the week, you should have your credentials. If not, please contact us and we'll get you set up.
Thank you. Okay, so another question is, what are some of the programs, and they're specifically inquiring about sessions or workshops that they can anticipate for the MFP fellows that are mandatory? And can they expect to receive a schedule soon? And I would say that they should contact their sponsoring organization for that.
Yes, I know. This is Dr. Outlaw, say that for our program, we do have our webinars identified and the times and all of that. And so I know that the other grantees function that way. And so again, what you're saying for them to go on the websites or conduct, when they have their orientations with their specific grantees, they will likely get a lot of that information, and they can use their grantees' websites also.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Outlaw.
Mm-hmm.
So, Angel, another question for you. This person just registered, and they're inquiring about how to change their password from the one that was emailed to them.
Okay, so if you go to your profile, there is, should be on the left sidebar, an option to change your password. Yes, go back to the screen. Update my password. There it is right there. So if you click there, and I encourage anyone, you get those temporary passwords to change your passwords immediately.
Thank you, Angel. Okay, so this question is, you all speak about funding as a fellow that is completing a master's in substance abuse counseling and who also has a nonprofit for domestic violence with coexisting issues of substance abuse and alcohol use. Is there funding for prevention education as a fellow as well?
Yes, you can just go onto SAMHSA website and look at the grants that you're interested in, and the process would be you would have to apply and see what happens from there. But yes, you could still apply for your organization.
Okay, this might be a question for you as well, Deborah. Many grant applications at the federal level require attainment of a doctoral degree to be eligible for funding. With SAMHSA, are current fellows without a doctorate considered competitive grant applications?
For SAMHSA grants, you don't have to have a doctorate to apply for grants, but you just have to read what the language is in the funding announcement to see if that is a requirement. But there are several grant funding opportunities that do not require you to have a doctorate.
Thank you, Deborah. So the next question is, how do you have proof that you attended this session? So when you close out, you should receive, and I'm not sure if it will come then, it should come up in the follow-up email tomorrow, an option to download a certificate of participation for today. If you do not have that option or don't receive it, you can email us at the mfpcc@myatech.com. Again, we're going to drop this information again in your chat box, and we'll see that you get that information, proof of attendance. Okay, the next question, is there currently funding for dissertations or travel to non-APA conventions?
That you would have to talk with your organization to see what the process for support for travel and to go attend conferences, because each organization has their own procedures and policies of how they do things. So I would say to go to your organization and find out, you know, if that's something they support.
Thank you, Deborah. Do you have multi-state grants as we work in more than one state?
So are you talking about like a block grant? You say a state grant, multi-state grants. I need clarification on that.
Okay. So maybe the person that submitted that question can provide a little bit more detail. And again, if you have questions, we still do have time to address some of your questions, so feel free to submit them in the questions box. Okay. This person's organization is in Hawaii and Alabama. So are you asking if SAMHSA has grants that could support locations in Hawaii and Alabama?
It sounds like to me that's a situation that, depending on what the funding announcement is saying, that they may be able to apply for the grant opportunity, and in their description of the activities or program that they're going to do, that they're going to program in Hawaii and Alabama.
Okay. Okay. So that would depend on the FOA requirement.
Exactly.
Okay. Got it. Thank you. Okay. Are there any opportunities for interdisciplinary networking or in-person meetings that the MFP coordinates?
Again, if it's for the fellows, again, it's your organization. I know over the years that the different organizations, they will have their summer institutes, their winter institutes, and they may have, if it's part of the mandatory requirements of a fellow, to participate in a face-to-face meeting. I'm going to ask Dr. Outlaw if she can follow up, because I know you go through this process every year as far as meetings with the fellows.
Thank you, Deborah. We have had occasions when we always invite fellows to participate on our webinars and in other meetings that we had in different locations, our institutes. We do invite, and we've had participation from some of the other directors of the projects and occasionally a fellow or two. So I guess the answer is yes, but it's been more informal. There is some planning among the grantees now about a celebration, and this is emerging. Janet Jackson, who is the project director, would have more detail about this, but it's emerging for our coming toward our 50th year that there's some discussion about planning to have all grantee institute at that particular point in time. But heretofore, I know historically there have been some grantee meetings where all of the grantees met or some of the grantees met. That was before my history as the academic consultant for the MFP at ANA. So I know there's a history that there were some meetings prior to my tenure, and there's some talk of a formal meeting coming up to celebrate our 50th, because we're in our 45th year now, and that we've had those occasions to invite people in an informal way. I hope that answers the question.
And I would think, Dr. Outlaw, with that type of meeting, that most likely you would invite some fellows to that meeting to...
Yes. It would be the meeting, like our intensive, where we have our staff and our fellows. It would be an intensive that encompasses all the grantees.
I guess I just want to also just say to the new fellows, just be mindful that we have six different organizations that are in the MFP program. So depending on what organization that you're connected to, then you have to go back and just see what the requirements are, what the expectations are for your organization, because they have some similarities as far as requirements, but there are several differences too. So I would just say just check with your organization MFP director to see what your requirements are.
And I would support that very strongly, that information that Deborah has just shared, because it's always best to go back to your home organization to see, again, as Deborah has said, what the requirements are, how it's supported, or you can fit that in. So I think that's sage advice.
Thank you, Dr. Outlaw and Deborah, for your responses. So we have comment and question here. Thank you all for your wealth of experience. For any of the presenters, since many of you are at the federal level, can you share any insights or words of wisdom to doctoral students on leveraging one's privilege as an MFP fellow or alum at the national and or state level?
I'm going to hand that over to you, Dr. Outlaw.
As I said in the history, that we encourage, and all the grantee agencies do this. We encourage that aside from filling out your questionnaires and your surveys to the give back, but one of the things that excites us most is to give presentations at the local, state, the national, and the international level, to do publications in clinical journals, policy journals, research journals, because as you leverage being a minority fellow, it really support the wonderful work that the fellows are doing in the public and solidifies what we say the contributions are and the investment that the SAMHSA Minority Fellowship Program in all our different disciplines are making in you. So it's like when you are a fellow, that's an honor to be a fellow. And when you do really good work and have it known in the ways that you have it known, then that then solidifies why it's important to have this program. So it's everybody benefits. You benefit from being a fellow, and we benefit and SAMHSA benefits when you demonstrate the contributions that you're making to end health disparities in mental health and substance abuse.
Ina, this is Gretchen Vaughn. I'd just like to chime in as well. I think that's a great question. Usually that's what we don't learn in graduate school, how to navigate SAMHSA and all the grant programs. And I think even in your academic institutions, many of them know about NIMH and NIH grant funding, but SAMHSA is more community-based, so I really think it is an opportunity for you to explore the different entities in SAMHSA. And if there's one in particular that looks interesting to you, explore it, ask questions, find out who the leadership is. And if we at MFPCC can help you navigate that process, we'd be happy to. But I think it's great that you're thinking about how to apply for grants at this point in your career, because it really sustains doing mental health services for ethnic minorities in their communities. So I applaud the question and the interest.
Excellent. And I applaud the responses. Those were excellent responses. Thank you both. So were there any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, we'd like to thank our presenters and you, the fellows, for joining us on today's webinar. We hope that we have successfully oriented you to the MFP program, and we look forward to working with you this year. In closing, we would like your feedback on this webinar. After you close the webinar window, a new window will pop up that includes a brief survey. And as I mentioned, you'll receive a follow-up email tomorrow in the event that you don't get to the survey today, but also will be a link where you can receive a certificate for participation today. So thank you, and this concludes our webinar. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.